Good morning, and welcome to session number 502, Pre-Custodial Intervention, Let Them Do the Damn Work. My name's Kevin Glick, and I'm from Yale University's Manuscripts and Archives, and I'll be the chair and commentator for this morning's session. Today's session will explore the strategy of pre-custodial intervention, or leveraging the knowledge and capability of active records creators to arrange, house, and describe records themselves, minimizing, if not eliminating, the time-consuming need for archivists to perform these responsibilities. Tested extensively at Yale University with creators of both manuscript collections and university records, the strategy has yielded measurable results in reducing processing time and costs and has allowed archivists to focus on other responsibilities. To better understand what we're describing as pre-custodial intervention, it might be helpful to briefly describe our more traditional approach to collecting, housing, arranging, describing manuscript and archival materials. Records creators were often approached at the end of their careers or lives, or survivors were approached afterwards. Records may have been accepted into the archives in whatever form offered by the donors. At that time, archival resources would be allocated for the full appraisal, rehousing, possible arrangement, and description. If the resources were not immediately available for this work, the materials might await allocation of such resources in a backlog. In contrast, pre-custodial intervention, as the name implies, involves intervening with the records creators before the records are transferred to the archives. We believe the implementation of this concept exemplifies the theme of this year's conference because it transforms archival practice in theory, redefining our professional boundaries. This morning, you'll hear from archivists with practical experience in developing and implementing methods and strategies for empowering records creators with traditional archival processing responsibilities. First, we will hear from Daniel Hartwig as record services archivist in the Yale University Archives. Daniel acts as the primary point of contact between the archives and Yale offices, creating records. He works with staff to make appraisal decisions, facilitates the pre-processing of records by offices prior to transfer, and identifies any issues, concerns, or special needs associated with potential accessions.
Good morning. My presentation will focus on examining PCI in the context of institutional repositories, specifically university archives, as again informed by my experience in the Yale University Archives. Herein, I will explore some of the advantages and disadvantages of PCI for institutional repositories, as well as some of the broader theoretical and practical issues surrounding PCI for the archival community as a whole. To provide just a little bit of background for our approach, the most important thing to note is that there is no formal records management program at Yale, although we do have some very dated record schedules posted on our website, which we do point offices to and which are used to some level of success every now and then. The University Archives, therefore, only performs the most basic records management activities. Why? Well, because Yale University Archives is composed of two FTE, head of the University Archives, now vacated by Kevin, and a record services archivist, myself. In addition, we have the partial time of 2 to 3 clerical and technical staff who perform the most basic accessioning and clerical and technical work. However, despite no formal mandate in the way of a university records or records management policy, over the last 5 years, we have averaged more than 200 accessions and well over 2,000 linear feet per year. Electronic records are starting to pour in as well. Last year, we took in over 115 gigabytes in a wide variety of formats. Given these numbers and our relatively small staff, we have no choice but to be innovative and proactive in our approach to processing, ensuring that what comes in is efficiently described and immediately accessible, generating no backlog. To do so, we treat accessioning as processing, rarely if ever going back to touch or process most university records. So how do we do it? PCI. By requiring creators to appraise, rehouse, arrange, describe, and in many instances, transfer records to the university archives themselves. In shifting these time-consuming responsibilities to creators, we greatly free up our time to address the most important needs of our department and our collections. So what exactly then do we do? We enter accession information into our collection management system, verify box contents for only 10% of the material that comes in that we designate for permanent preservation, encode the folder-level inventory provided by the office into EAD, update the finding aid and catalog record, barcode and label the boxes, and send to storage. That's it. The total time required to accession slash process materials can just be a few minutes. So what are the advantages of this approach? Obviously, first and foremost, it allows you to do a lot more with a lot less. Second, it reduces the bulk of material transferred to the archives and hence the time required to process it. Third, it mitigates the post-facto detective work often needed to determine context, content, and, most importantly, any restrictions that may need to be applied to the records. A fourth advantage, particularly in the case of electronic records, is that this approach allows archivists to provide guidance that increases the chances of records surviving in an accessible and reliable format, and hence delay the burden of preservation for the repository. On the other side of the coin, there are certainly disadvantages to this approach, first being the very act of turning over responsibility to non-archivists. Take appraisal. It is often very difficult for a creator to determine the historical significance of records while they're being created, let alone navigate the dozens of hard-to-use and difficult-to-understand record schedules needed to help them guide them in their decisions. Throwing concepts such as permanent, non-permanent, or requiring temporary retention, and you're likely to end up with lots of confusion. All this is to say that PCI will likely have you taking in material you otherwise wouldn't. But let me back up here. Because to do appraisal or arrangement and description, creators need to be trained how to do so. But if you have a small staff to begin with and are trying to reduce your workload, to now introduce developing and implementing dozens of training sessions, you're really not saving time, merely substituting one set of responsibilities for another. And yet without training, how can you expect this to be successful? However, even with all the training in the world, it is of little use in offices with high turnover, lack of institutional knowledge, or that rely on ever new students to do their work. Sustaining an active and effective relationship with creators can therefore be a very time-consuming and difficult. A third disadvantage, particularly in the case of electronic records, is that creators just often don't have the time, expertise, or technical support to care for the records identified for long-term preservation. This can lead to neglect, corruption, and unreliability of records. A fourth disadvantage is the potential for offices to become self-conscious or unnatural in their record keeping, which clearly undermines authenticity and burdens the creative process. So given this brief discussion of some of the advantages and disadvantages of PCI, let me turn to two important issues for our profession. First, with the recent philosophical shift in the archival community's approach to processing brought on by MPLP, we need to boldly consider new approaches to efficiently and expediently acquiring, accessioning, processing, and providing access to archival material. PCI is one such approach, but are we, in adopting it, delegating archival responsibility? I think the answer is yes and no. Take appraisal, for example. Yes, we turn over some appraisal decisions to creators, which again may lead to transfer material we don't want. However, this is not all the appraisal that goes on. Archivists create record schedules slash collection development policies that identify the material of long-term historical interest. We then work with or point creators to use said documents. And when things go wrong, we go back to them, explain things, and improve the process. As for arrangement and description, we too have the final say and may augment or revise descriptions as needed, or even go back to offices to have materials more fully described if need be. As it stands then, although we in fact delegate certain aspects of the archival process, we as archivists still maintain our fundamental responsibility for the process as a whole. A second critical issue concerns utility. In other words, do the benefits of PCI outweigh its disadvantages? This is a difficult question to answer on a number of levels. First, a number of things obviously have to be in place or developed prior to implementation. Among others, these include effective record schedules or collection development policies, as well as training sessions to teach creators in how to use them. Both of these, however, require significant commitment from the repository and a willingness to accept the steep learning curve involved. Depending on the repository, then, PCI may not be a viable option for immediate payoff. However, if you do have the time and accept the inherent trade-offs involved, it will provide a long-term benefit to your repository. A second part to the utility issue concerns the usefulness of creator-produced descriptions. That is, how useful from a research or historical perspective is description provided by creators who are often unaware or cannot foresee the ultimate value of their records. That is to say, it is not any worse, however, than our already admittedly flawed or subjective terminology we use to provide access to our records. But anyone who has, say, dealt with terms such as miscellaneous, general, or my personal favorite, general miscellaneous, also knows that creator-produced description can truly be absolutely useless. As a result, PCI often requires that you go back to the creators and request fuller or more accurate description, or invest the time in doing it yourself, the latter defeating the very purpose of PCI. Nevertheless, I contend that just having folder-level accession inventories available online and easily searchable is benefit enough, greatly facilitating access and retrieval beyond the capability of any and all approaches to processing a small repository can muster. Furthermore, at least in our case, given that these records are likely restricted, subject to use by the creating office only, providing original descriptions provided by creators, again, greatly facilitates access and retrieval without our intervention, again, lessening our workload and our reference requests. To sum up, PCI is an extremely useful means for empowering records creators to take responsibility for the records and to help us as archivists by appraising, arranging, describing, and providing access to their own archival material. Although archives face clear challenges in implementing and successfully administering PCI, there is no question that it significantly reduces processing time and workload for archivists, allowing us to focus on what we deem most important. And for those of you who fear PCI too greatly empowers creators and shirks our professional responsibility, have no fear. We're still in charge. We're still keeping an eye on what's going on. We're just happy to have someone else do the damn work. Thank you.
Just to add a little bit to Daniel's talk about institutional repositories and pre-custodial intervention, I thought I'd say a few words about electronic records and institutional repositories. In theory, there are a number of advantages to pre-custodial intervention with electronic records at an institutional repository. Any guidance we can provide to records creators can help ensure records are created and set aside properly, increasing the chance that the records will survive in a form where they can be accessioned and preserved. Also, with electronic records, it may be even more important to get help with description, as the creator is uniquely positioned to provide contextual information that the archivist is unlikely to be able to fully provide after the fact. Unfortunately, in practice, the Yale University Archives has not succeeded in fully implementing pre-custodial intervention of electronic records to the level that we have been with traditional paper-based records. University electronic record systems are often very large and technically complicated, beyond the understanding and outside system administration privileges of the level of staff that we're most often able to deal with. We've had some success this past year with record types like administrative correspondence in the form of email, having staff perform appraisal, preliminary arrangement, and rudimentary description. However, this case, as with most others, still is very labor-intensive for specifically the electronic records archivist myself, who normally must create the entire submission information package and transfer the records to the digital repository, normally without much assistance at all from the creators. So our second speaker, Laura Tatum. Laura Tatum is Yale's first architectural records archivist. She enjoys the money and power that come with managing Yale's extensive and growing architectural holdings. Acting as project archivist, she previously processed the Arrow Sarnen collection at Yale and now works with several active architectural firms to acquire their records on an ongoing basis, making them available to students and researchers. Laura?
I have to say I'm astonished to see so many of you here at the crack of dawn. So at this conference, I've heard lots of discussion, let me just move this a little bit, about some of the guilt feelings that some architectivists that some archivists have concerning minimal processing and about non-archivists performing some of the traditional functions of archivists. An underlying theme of the conference seems to be in some ways that of confessing imagined archival sins. People are feeling guilty about having students doing some of the processing of collections. They are worried that if they don't organize their materials, then they're not really archivists, or that the minimal description they do for collections is all those collections will ever get. I'm here to tell you that it's time to get rid of the guilt. Jennifer Meehan, my colleague at the Beinecke, gave an inspiring talk in the session on the evolving finding aid, one theme of which was the need to revise our own expectations of ourselves as archivists as the ultimate authorities to our collections. Mark Green also touched on this topic, too, in his plenary address when he talked about modern collections being too big to process at a traditional level. The majority of the collections that I bring in and work with will always be too big to process fully. I'll never be the authority on them in the way that I might have been for other collections I processed in the past. So the finding aid that I show the records creators themselves how to make will be the most authoritative access tool and reference to the collection, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. The only possible way that I can provide access to the enormous collections from active firms, and here, actually, if you go forward, you can see what part of one shipment of the shelf-ready archives that were delivered by one firm is to work closely with the firm well before the records are transferred to make sure that they arrive not only in a physical form that we can open immediately to researchers, but also to show them how to create finding aids to the material. And in the case of architectural records, this finding aid takes the form of a project index. I'll just briefly take you through my step-by-step process. Thank you. for when the firm has not hired their own archivist. The initial meeting that I have with the firm is typically with a principal of the firm and the firm's publicity staff. They often already have some ideas about what will be transferred. The discussion about appraisal then begins here at a very macro level. I have to both manage their expectations. We don't want everything. We definitely can't take everything, especially not your models. But I also have to act as the voice of history. We don't just want the projects that they consider their greatest hits or their most successful published projects. We also want their competition entries. We want their unbuilt projects. We want things that are on a much smaller scale than some that, for example, the Petronas Towers. This is also where I tell them very gently that the way that the records arrive at manuscripts and archives is the way that they will stay. As Daniel mentioned before, we're not going to process them further once they get to manuscripts and archives, and so if they want people to be able to access those records, they need to process them at a level that the researcher would be able to use. So they can either hire an archivist, which some firms have done, or they can have a member of their staff do the processing under my supervision and training. We consider this person's time and the supplies that the firm purchases to rehouse the materials part of the firm's donation to us. Most large firms see this as a tax write-off, and it's important to make this a condition of the gift. The second step is to meet with the person, who is often an architect moonlighting as a member of the publicity department, who will be doing the actual processing. I show him or her the standard series to architectural records so they have some kind of intellectual reference point of how the materials will eventually be presented to researchers, and some examples of project indexes. And I actually have a couple of slides that are just brief examples of project indexes. This is one that was created by Centerbrook Architects and Planners. You can see there's job number, the project name, and then along the side where you have the very small type are all of the different types of materials that they've transferred to us. And then the next one, the most recent one that I've helped a firm create, is for Kevin Roche, John Dinkaloo Associates. And these are the materials that they've transferred to us so far. I also have I have handouts that that have a little bit of this, and I have very few handouts because I didn't expect to see so many of you this morning. But they're available here for you. So this is also the point where I go with them in depth into a tool called the Appraisal Grid, which I also have a copy of here and is published in the SAA Manual to Architectural Records that was published in 2006. And that basically tells them exactly what types of material we do and don't want. I show them what supplies to order, and I recommend vendors. I give them a list of processing guidelines that are written in English so that they're not full of archival jargon. And then we shake hands. The person smiles very weakly and looks very overwhelmed. And I promise to come back when they're ready to tackle a single project together. And that's usually the way that I go about it. Let's just look at one thing first and do it together. So you can see, as Daniel mentioned before, too, that none of this is really saving me, the archivist, a lot of time or effort just yet. The whole process takes a lot of hand-holding. And as Daniel also mentioned, people are very concerned about organizing things the right way. And of course, you know, the answer is don't reorganize things, just give them to us the way that you actually used them. People who work in architecture firms do not automatically intuit archival protocols, theories, and standards. We are not going to be out of jobs anytime soon. But they do understand needing to be able to find a drawing set when someone comes looking for it immediately, and therefore can easily put themselves into the shoes of the researcher. On my next visit to the firm, we talk about the project index templates and discuss how these can be adapted to reflect the types of documentation that the firm creates more or less of. For example, if a firm is known for doing lots of landscape architecture work, we might include a column in the project index for landscape architecture. Other firms, that's not so important. We're not going to include that. The project index is very flexible in that way. I tell them not to feel that the appraisal grid is set in stone, that if one or two drawings that we don't want are in a roll, don't open the whole roll just to pull those two out. Give us the whole thing. You know, we want things to move quickly and smoothly for everybody, not just for me, but for them too. I describe the level of detail in the project index that will be useful for the researcher, the level of detail for the folder labeling, and let them have at it. So then what happens next is the first transfer happens, which is always an interesting moment. You know, I get a call from the firm, and they say, we're ready to deliver the records to you, and I get the records, and I throw up my hands. Oh, my God, what have you done? you know, and I have to take some of the blame because obviously I didn't make things clear enough to them. A couple of examples recently were I received 6-page boxes full of correspondence that was just labeled correspondence with no date, no indication of who the correspondence was with. That's an example where I can tell the firm, you know, this is not going to be useful to the researcher. This is probably not even going to be useful to you if you need to come back and find some of that correspondence later on. But again, this is brand new to these people. You know, they stuffed too many drawings of too many different types in a tube. You can't even open it. There are sketches in there getting torn. You know, we go back, we regroup, we say, you know, why don't you put the different sets into different tubes, and that will be easier for everybody. It's all about the researcher. You know, it comes back to the researcher and having the people doing the processing at the firm understand that this is eventually going to be used by somebody other than them. And then usually the next transfer goes extremely well. They get it right, and away we go. And in the best of all worlds, this happens on an ongoing kind of record scheduled basis where, you know, it comes every 6 months, it comes once a year, something like that. Of course, that's all the best of all possible worlds, and that is never what happens. One of the ongoing issues is that there is an inevitable loss of momentum. You know, people are very, very excited to start giving their records to Yale. You know, hooray, they can be accessed, they're open for research, but then, you know, other things get in the way. These are architects. These are working people who are using their time to process these papers, and often they get called onto another project, and the archives processing project slips, which I understand. Another issue is, well, if you don't want it, who does? What should we do with it? And usually the answer is, well, if we don't want it, it probably doesn't have permanent historical value, and you should shred it. But a lot of the people at these firms are very attached to their records, and they feel that you know, they should hold on to them, and you know, eventually maybe the principals pass on, and then the materials are shredded. Let's go to the next slide. Let's just go to the next slide. So I'll talk about the benefits very quickly. So obviously the archivist benefits. I benefit greatly from pre-custodial intervention. Much less time is spent processing. I supervise two part-time students who are each processing collections that came in, all of a piece in the traditional way, and there is no way that they could possibly ever keep up with the volume of materials that come in from firms. So less time spent processing. Greater involvement with the firm. What I lose in authority about the collections themselves, I gain in familiarity with the firm. When researchers come in, they want to know what kinds of projects have come in, they want to know what kinds of records have come in, what the firm is like and who is working there and how big it is and what they're doing now. I am able to provide a much higher level of reference about that. There's also a lot better control of what comes in the door. We all know that it's much easier to keep things out than to throw them out once they come in, and so here you basically just cut it off at the pass and say, we don't want this stuff, don't send it to us. Also, the finding aid is available for immediate use by researchers. What typically happens with a transfer of records is that they will send over the records and then they will email me the latest iteration of the project index, and so I can make that project index immediately available to researchers. And then again, the costs are picked up by the firm. We don't have to search for grant funding to get somebody to process this collection all in one shot. And we couldn't either because these are ongoing accessions. There are also benefits to the researcher. Again, the finding aid is available for immediate use. Not only do the records come in already processed, but there is also an access tool to them. You know, somebody could conceivably call me up on a Wednesday and say, when is the Ford Foundation material coming in? And I could say it's coming in on Thursday, and on Friday I could give them processed boxes and a finding aid, and they would be able to open it all up and have know what was in everything right away. Again, also mentioned by Daniel, the records are arranged by the creator, and the creator can often provide a context for the material that someone from outside the firm wouldn't be able to. And then the benefits to the firm are that it actually helps them realize what they have and what is of particular value. I am often approached by firms in crisis who say to me, oh my God, all of our records are stored in this terrible drafty warehouse down by the river. Can we just give this to you, like deliver it in a truck? And the answer, of course, is no. But one of the benefits, as I explain it to them, is that they themselves will know what they have once they have one of their own doing the processing of this material. They may not know that they don't have material for a certain project, or they may not know that they have amazing, you know, design development drawings for a different project. The materials are also organized by somebody who's familiar with them, who it's sometimes tricky to explain to students or even to other processing archivists the different phases of design, the different iterations that a project goes through. These things are organized by an architect, by someone who has practiced with these kinds of materials. And the other benefit is that the materials get moved off-site very quickly if the storage space is an issue. Again, as I mentioned, the warehouse space can be a problem. I have been at several firms where every nook and cranny is jammed with papers, and if they are having somebody process it on-site, one of their own staff members, they can get it out of there really pretty much as quickly as somebody can process it, because I'm not demanding any kind of item level description or anything. So now I will let Kevin, I'll turn it over to Kevin, and he will talk to you a little bit about some of the issues with digital materials we're facing.
So as with institutional electronic records, Manuscripts and Archives has struggled to implement pre-custodial intervention with active architecture firms donating their records. In most cases, the records of architecture projects are complex and voluminous in digital form. And as Laura mentioned at the end, if storage space is an issue, digital storage space is often an issue for these firms. They've been stretching the limits of their digital storage for years, if not decades, by the point that we start to talk to them. The dynamic and innovative nature of the profession of architects adds to the complexity of their electronic records. In the last two decades, there's been a dramatic evolution of the electronic record systems employed by architects. When an archives is dealing with a well-established firm with a bit of a history, why else would we be preserving their records? Often this means many different and sometimes unique digital file formats and encodings. As they are innovative, many of these file formats or encodings may be obsolete or at least very rarely utilized in the community, presenting new research opportunities or requirements upon the archives. Many formats, file formats, are tightly controlled proprietary formats that carry the baggage of very expensive applications to use them. The extent of the files can be overwhelming at times. When working through the steps that were identified by Laura here, we met early on with one firm to identify a small, simple prototype architectural project that existed in electronic form to examine in this past year. And we were presented with a directory listing of more than 10,000 digital files named with a hard-to-understand coding scheme that didn't have a key. In addition, the digital files do not normally manifest or map to records in outputs that would be easily understandable to the users of architectural records, like sections and elevations. We have the opportunity to give the paper records right away because they're in a form that right away every person that comes in understands, with a little bit of help from the finding aid, what it is that they're looking at. But really, the files are not saved as records, but instead saved as records components that need to be combined together, linked together, layered upon one another in order to manifest actual records that were utilized by the architecture firms. Because these are usually CAD files, and along with a number of different presentation layers that are a series of interrelated layers of data that need to be combined. To complicate matters, much of the contextual information on how these files could be combined or should be combined into records is often stored inside the sum of the records components themselves, and not always the same types of records components. In the first simple example that we dealt with this year, the contextual metadata was text that was saved as images, as cover sheets to certain layers of CAD files. So the really only practical way to figure out where the records were would be to try to figure out the pattern that they had followed in where they put these things, find those files, open them, and view and either print or somehow copy over the text in some way so that then you could make decisions about where are the records that you're trying to deal with in this case. And as the 10,000 record component file example was a very small one, as we start to get to hundreds of thousands of files and terabytes upon terabytes of data, who would do that work becomes unclear, definitely. Another issue to deal with is that the staff expertise in the firm to be able to help us with the electronic records. Even the most helpful staff, perhaps, that has hired consultant or set allocated time to a project like this, probably doesn't have the full skill set necessary to deal with the electronic records. We're usually either dealing with a pseudo-archivist or pseudo-architect who doesn't have the technical understanding and skill to deal with the digital files, probably didn't have much relationship to how they were saved, and maybe doesn't understand anything about coding schemes or how they might package them together to transfer them to us. Or there are often large systems departments in some of these firms, and they're very skilled at some of the technical aspects, but don't necessarily have the architectural background, especially to do something like follow Laura's appraisal grid and decide this is what I need to take and put, and these are the things that I need to give. This thing is valued over that thing. And so there's a fine line there on what it is we're even looking for in somebody to deal with. And so what it means is it puts an increasing burden on the electronic records archivist to do much of this work. And if you're lucky enough to have staff time to allocate to that, you might be able to do that. If you don't, it will dramatically slow down the process, and that's what we've run into. So since I think that both Laura and Daniel did a good job in summarizing their work, and since we've got such a large group that got up this morning very easily, apparently, what we were hoping to do was hear from you all a bit on what you think. And so what we've done is proposed a few discussion questions. I'm not sure how this will work. But what we have are archivists of the future going to have the same skills that we were all trained in? What will their jobs look like? Is more and more of this delegation going to happen? How useful is it for repositories? Some of that has been answered by at least my two colleagues. How useful is it for researchers? Are there other ideas for lessening workloads, less processing? Doesn't necessarily equal less time spent on a project we've talked about? And are we delegating our archival responsibility? What do people think about that? What are those responsibilities, and what makes us so special? So I was wondering if anybody had any comments, questions, or would like to talk about the discussion questions.
I have one comment or question about the electronic records. So given the fact that I work in our culture farm as a real I find that when my workers, my users, create a CAD file, say prior to 1995, the reason that the layers get so confused and the reason that there's no index to the work that they do is that they don't consider that to be the record of the project. So I'm wondering if you have given any thought to, since it's going to be so difficult for an archivist to go back and reconstruct the digital information that went out to create the printed drawings, because a lot of these older drawings weren't used in electronic format, they had to be printed in order to build the building. I'm wondering if you might not just throw your hand up and say, I don't know, what do? You say you just don't want them? Or do you just say, we'll take them in this horrible format and describe them as, hey, look, we have this horrible format, and if any researcher wants to do it? I'm being totally honest. I mean, you guys can't sit there and figure out, you know, AutoCAD in the middle 80s and how people put together the layers. And it depended on the skill of the draftsman as well. So how about the fact that those older electronic records may not actually be records?
Since this is recorded, I need to repeat the question. What I'm going to say is the commenter suggested that perhaps many, especially in older systems, many of the digital files weren't created to be records and aren't records, and perhaps we shouldn't be trying to preserve them as records.
In the same way as you
would. Is the same way as we might nowadays. Yeah, I guess that was for me, huh?
I can say, is it on? I can say Kevin and I have actually talked about this quite a bit because this was something that this is something that we thought of. This is something that other people have said to us before too, and we haven't come to a decision about it yet. I mean, I think when generally the architectural archivist community is talking about digital records, we are talking about, oh my God, look at all of these like 3D models that are the actual record now. You know, these, and especially with the, you know, BIM models and things like that, you know, where the drawings are just sent immediately to the contractor electronically, they're never actually printed out, there is no working set. That is kind of the record. And so, you know, this project that we were looking at from 1997, you know, was kind of on the verge of that. It was, you know, kind of partly electronic and partly probably printed out. But there is a question about, you know, who is going to, you know, even if we were to say, okay, you know what, the actual record is the printed record, and so just print these things out, the expense to either us or to the researcher or to the firm is enormous to actually do reprinting of all of that stuff.
I might add, it also depends on what record you're trying to document. Especially if what you're trying to document is built objects or the result of the project, often outputs are much clearer the thing that you're looking for. But in that, one of the emphasis of the collecting that we're doing at Yale is on the intellectual process behind the design of the building. We're often interested, not always, but sometimes, in what were they doing during the creation process. And so that's why sometimes we do want to mess around in the fits and starts of what did they do. This is what's so interesting now, where every nowadays that it's so easy to create these CAD files that every possible idea that they're coming up with starts to get put out. The earlier CAD, when it took some more expertise, they went through a little bit of the thinking before they went through the effort to start to create the components of the CAD. And then before that, when they needed the draftsman, mostly it really was thought out before they went through the effort to start to draw these things out. But as in paper, we're interested in collecting the sketches and the part of what the first draftsman might have done, and then, oh, they had a different idea and they went back often in some of the collections. Often we want to know, what was it that they were doing? We're wanting to document the activity that the firms went through, often because several of the firms that we've chosen are innovative in the way that they're designing. And so maybe they used innovative techniques, and so maybe we want to document those. Maybe we're making it more difficult on ourselves by doing that, definitely. But that's something that we do need to think about. Manaz?
Yeah, actually two questions. One is, it'd be great to hear a little bit about how you manage access restrictions, especially because maybe sometimes the creators are not always aware of all the laws involved in, you know, making the records available. But the other question is, what you're describing sounds a lot like what our institution calls records management. So I'm curious if it's a semantic distinction or if there's some other kind of qualitative differences between what you're describing and records management.
To repeat the question, let's take one at a time. The first question was, what about access restrictions, especially if the creator doesn't quite understand the implications of access restrictions. Does that sound about right? Okay.
Or somebody else. This is supposed to be a discussion, not just us talking. So.
Can I have an example of a kind of restriction?
Sometimes the client is very shy of any kind of publicity. They don't want anybody looking at the project that was created for them for some amount of time. Sometimes there are the client has put intellectual property restrictions, and they've said actually all of this material is ours. And in fact, we won't take projects that the client has said you can never show this. One issue that came up and that we just have kind of ignored, I have to say, was the issue of sometimes security in terms of, you know, we have Saarinen's drawings of the Gateway Arch, and right after September 11th, people seemed very concerned that this was going to be a target, and so they wanted to know who was requesting access to those drawings, which we noted and filed away. So those are some kinds of access restrictions.
And would you say there's anything particular that you're doing to deal with those access restrictions?
The firm, the only firm so far that has a lot of access restrictions has, we've worked with them to have they're only, it's a very, very short time period that these things can be restricted. We say, you know, if it's going to be any time longer than 7 years, then don't send us that project at all. But, you know, they started transferring to us some things, and they said these things can be opened in 2011 or whatever, and that's okay. We can deal with that. But if it's going to be indefinite, we're just not going to take it.
On the University Archive side, it's a lot clearer. There are a whole host of restrictions that mostly the creators don't need to think about. That's our job to apply those, and we do apply those. The second question was, isn't this just records management? The answer is yes, essentially. But records management without mandate staff or funding, mostly. So in both situations, on the collecting manuscript model, it's essentially guidance mostly after the fact. They've created most of the things, and we're saying, you know, fix the stuff that you've got. And, oh, by the way, all the things that you do now in the future, if they continue to act, why don't you employ these records management practices? It would help us all out a lot, and you wouldn't need to redo these things. On the university archive side, it's just a when I might talk to other university archivists, they all say, well, why aren't you just fixing all this with records management? And that's a simple enough answer. We just don't have any records management staff mandate or department of any kind. And so this was established as a way to deal with that fact when there wasn't one and there was a need to do these sorts of things. The question was, with these complex types of architectural records, wouldn't it be easier and maybe more effective to capture this information through oral history? A part of the interesting answer to that is the same. That is actually happening simultaneously in most of these cases. It's just driven by researchers primarily who feel that they need more information. And so they're, if the architect's still alive in the firm, or the firm is still active, they're going back and asking the architect to create oral histories.
I'll just add really quickly that that Kevin Roche has a mind like a steel trap. He is 87 years old, I want to say, at this point. And I have a faculty member that works extremely closely with him, you know, and was working with him on the Sarnam project, is now working with him on his own papers, and is taking oral histories from him about various projects. But, you know, those aren't the records of the building that you know, a lot of architectural historians are very interested in. They're of course extremely interested in the context that the architect can provide, and so that is another very good reason to do the oral histories. But they also want to look at the sections and elevations and plans.
I'm curious about the mechanics of the people who do the work in the offices, because basically it's an add-on to their regular job. So are you writing this into their job description? And if not, are you having union problems? Because I'm from Columbia, a lot of people at that level are union members, and there would be hell to pay if they were doing things that weren't in their job description.
The question was, in the university records situation, are staff that are doing this work in offices, is it actually part of their job or not? Technically, it is not part of their job. We've got similar situations at Yale that you do at Columbia. This work that is done by the offices is all done by our request. And as there's no mandate, if they say no, we do. We have to figure out something. As we've started to look at what to do in that sort of situation is, we look on a consultation basis. We have begun to offer a service where you can, you know, hire an archival assistant to do the work with you, sort of thing. But trying to emphasize that we still can't do it even if you can't, but maybe we can give you someone who's been trained who can come into your office and do the thing. But we do hear quite often that it's not my job to do that sort of thing.
Who puts the stuff into archivally acceptable containers, boxes, file folders, sleeves?
Who puts the question was, who puts the material, who houses the material in archival boxes or folders or what have you? In all cases, it's the offices or the records creators. This is the main task that we're trying to get them to do. On the university, in both cases, we provide the materials. Depending upon the situation, they might be paying for the materials, or we might be paying for the materials. It depends on how much we want it and whether they can provide resources. But the idea is we usually don't have the space or the manpower to do it. We need their help.
Since the in the physical assets, pre-custodial work is making selections, doing the refolding, whatever. Isn't it analogous to the digital world to ask the creators to, say, make selections of particular sketches at a particular stage of the drawing process, ask them to, say, generate archival PDFs or something like that, and ask them to surrender that kind of material? I know they wouldn't do it, but is it, you know, a reasonable request to make, since it seems to be really comparable what you're doing?
The question was, is it not comparable to ask creators to select the records in electronic form similarly to the way that we're asking them to do it in paper form? Absolutely. That's what we're trying to get out of records creators. The point I was just trying to make was that we're not succeeding quite as well as we are with paper, mostly because the staff that are available to do this work in either the offices or the firms don't have the skills necessary to identify the records as records and set them aside, either because they don't understand the records or because they don't understand how computers put ones and zeros onto storage media in some way. And so it's usually either one or the other extreme or a little bit of both. That doesn't mean that we won't find that, and we're trying to train as much as we can. It just takes more time on our part and more training to get them to that level. The comment from the audience was that it's very important to establish an archival contact inside the firm, perhaps to translate between the different sides and handle the flow back and forth between the entities. I think maybe we've got time for one more.
My only comment to what he's just saying is I'm with an art museum in Philadelphia, and we're now trying to institute a records management program. And I'm going through inventory. Usually most agents want to blow their brain down. But the problem with having that contact, which we try to establish, that representative that I'm going to talk to or the person we talk to, there's always such a quick turnaround with staff. So that's why we are really pushing with whatever we come up with. And we know it's always going to be in the work, the process, to have something posted on the internet, some kind of guidance, going back to records management, going back to the really general retention schedule. That's the only way we're
going to
keep everybody on the same page.
The comment from the audience was that one of the issues that you can run into with archival contacts in the firms is that there's a high turnover rate of those people, and so it's important to have written documentation or best practices to guide as staff change over. And if there, I'd add to that that there a few different sessions talked about some of that written documentation that's been done by manuscript repositories that's come out of the Interperez project creator guidelines. The Beinecke Library has a good document on guidelines for creators. If I think we've reached the end of the session, but if there's any more questions or comments, feel free to let any of us know. Thank you very much.